Hey, welcome to this episode of Steel Watching. My name is Eric, and I am one of your hosts.
And I'm Sarah, and I'm the other one of the hosts.
So today's episode is Steel Trap, episode number 10. Now, before we get into this, I do want to say that taken to task, but we really weren't taken to task. It's just, it was brought to our attention that we overlooked something, and it's probably my fault because I'm not really into those kinds of movies.
I missed it, but, too.
Yes, the Maltese Falcon. You remember Thou Shalt Not Steal, character Gutman.
Yep.
Yeah, that was the name of the character played by Sidney Greenstreet in the Maltese Falcon. And we did not mention that. And this was from Melody Specht Kelly. She brought this to our attention and also pointed out that the dingus in this is a cursed painting, whereas in the Maltese Falcon, it was a cursed falcon statue. So, yeah, we missed that one. Thank you, Melody, for bringing that to our attention.
It's not the first time this show will riff off the Maltese Falcon. I think it does it two more times, so... Yeah. Got two more to look forward to.
And it's probably not the first time that we've missed a movie reference. So
No.
It's probably the first time it's been brought to our attention, but it's probably not the first time.
This is why we have the wonderful Steel Watchers community, because they yes, know, like, there's so many that if we miss it, someone else knows it, and it's great. So
yes.
Thank you.
So if you're not a member of Steel Watchers on Facebook, get
there's
there.
There's the plug.
There's the plug. Yes.
There's the plug.
Commercial. All right. Let's get into the episode. Steel Trap first aired on December the 10th, 1982. It was written by Michael Gleason and directed by Sidney Hayers. Now, I went back to Judith's book for the episode synopsis. Thank you, Judith Smooth. Thank you, Judith Smooth. Judith? Oh, man, what a day. Thank you, Judith Moose.
This is getting great. It's a great start.
Say that. Say her name really fast 10 times, and you will find that you have 37 tons.
She'll appear and yell at you for getting her name wrong.
Yes. I'm sorry, Judith. Anyway, thank you, Judith, for your book. It's been a wonderful source of assistance in this. I did use the TV guide synopsis. It's not the more extensive synopsis, but I really love the way it's written. And, you know, you and I had talked in the past about having a college degree in literature and then going to write episode synopses for TV Guide. But this one says, guests are murdered one by one at a house party crashed by Laura and Remington after their client declines his invitation by committing suicide.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, what a way to... No, I don't want to show up to your party. So I'm,
yeah, talk about
I need an excuse. I'm going
to
blow my brains out.
Why didn't I think of that?
I mean, it's such a good excuse.
You can't argue it at any rate. Like,
well, that's true.
Wow. TV guy did it again.
Yes. In Judith's book, she also points out that this is the first of four appearances made by Lynn Randall, also known as Rocky Sullivan, who at the time of the shooting was married to executive producer and co-creator Michael Gleason.
Oh, I didn't know that. I suppose I should have, because I've read the book.
That's okay. Your memory's starting to get like mine.
It is very
short and old. Yep. Mm-hmm. She also notes that part of this episode, specifically the outside scenes in the lagoon area, were filmed in the same lagoon area that was originally used for Gilligan's Island.
Huh. So they did get off the island.
Well.
Sort of.
No, they just didn't show up for the filming of Remington Steel.
Yeah.
Well, no, they did get off the island because there were several movies afterwards where they
That's
got
true.
Off. Anyway.
Yeah.
Different show. Okay, so it starts out where Steel and Laura are showing up at the doctor's office. Dr. Mind blank.
Bellows. Dr. Arthur Bellows. Yeah.
Arthur Bellows, yes.
You have to say it very like that. Arthur Bellows.
Yes. And, well, first of all, Steel gets it wrong. He says, Nurse Ratchet.
Yeah.
The correct name, and this is from the Ken Kesey novel, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and I think was also subsequently made into a movie.
Yep.
It's Ratched. R-A-T-C-H-E-D. Not E.T.
And it's the film was Stanley Kubrick did the film.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he gets the name wrong. And I was wondering, was this a typo in the script made by somebody who just was typing it up and got it wrong, thought it was a misspelling and tried to correct it? Was it an error on the part of Michael Gleason? Was it an inadvertent mispronunciation on Brosnan's part? Or was it a deliberate choice to show how Steele can get the little things wrong?
I'm wondering if it's because I've just Googled it, because I've always heard people say ratchet with a T as well. Like, I've heard that quite frequently. And well,
because that's the way you would expect it to be, because that is a legitimate word, ratchet.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if it's one of those like common misconceptions that just sort of became the norm.
Accepted.
Like how people say for all intensive purposes, and I want to strangle them.
That's not it.
I wonder if it's something like that, where people have been getting it wrong for so long that they've just sort of, it's just become like the accepted wrong.
Misheard lyrics.
Like, I'm wondering if it's something like that, because that's what I wondered too when I heard him say it, but I've heard other people say it like that too.
Yeah. Well, you know, things like that do happen. I'm reminded of Manfred Mann's Earth Band's hit song, Blinded by the Light, written by Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, yeah.
They replace a reference to an automobile with a feminine hygiene product.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Because they misheard the lyric.
Yep.
And I suspect that pretty much everybody since then has quotes that song line wrong. Okay, well, let's talk about the doctor blowing his brains out as a way of declining his invitation. What? The Devil's Playground. Obviously, this is a parody, a reference, homage, whatever you want to call it, to the Playboy Mansion.
Yes.
How would getting an invitation to that cause somebody to blow their brains out? Because if you looked at the invitation when it was shown on the screen, and it was shown on the screen, all it says is you're invited to a weekend at the Devil's Playground. What's so frightening about that?
That is the mystery. That's the part of the mystery that is never solved. It's the inciting incident, to be an English teacher here. It's the inciting incident that gets them to go to the island, but it never
is explained.
I mean, I guess we have to just assume that it's not the invitation itself. Like, maybe he was just really, I don't know. I really don't know. Like, they never explain it.
Well, the presumption is that you're going to show up. There's going to be all these scantily dressed women. So I would think that if somebody like Bellows, Dr. Arthur Bellows, was depressed, then he might find that appealing. So it's kind of one of those. I'm wondering if there was some sort of prior communication.
Threat? Yeah.
Well, threat, yeah. Or just some other communication from Ambrose Blinn, the guy who was behind the Devil's Playground, Devil's Magazine. I wonder if there's some sort of communication that suggested to the doctor that this was not going to be a fun and games weekend. It was going to be something more substantial, more frightening, more of an issue for him.
But then you'd think he would have just not gone. I mean, there's declining your invitation, and then there's, you know, declining your invitation.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know. Yeah. It's one of those things where it just, The two things don't go together. I mean, it's like peanut butter and ketchup. I mean, you just don't go together.
Gross. Okay, I do have to air some dirty laundry here. My husband puts ketchup on his French toast, which I think is appalling, and I'm just calling him out on it. It's a British thing. It's very gross.
Maple syrup, yes.
Yeah, GM, exactly.
Yes. Ketchup.
Right? It's just wrong. It's just wrong. But in terms of what you're saying, I agree.
Should I edit this out so you don't get in trouble with your husband?
He doesn't. No. I think the world should know. I think it's time.
Okay.
But yeah, I think you're right. Like, it's weird. I almost wonder if he was threatened, or if maybe he was facing, because he was known for having multiple malpractice suits and being an alcoholic and whatnot. Mm-hmm. I wonder if there was a threat against his practice or his life or something that caused him to just check out before he got there, because you get the impression that anybody that went, Randy intended to kill. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, but the invitation, of course, wasn't from Randy. It was from Blinn. No. So maybe there was some connection between the doctor and either the Devil's Magazine or Blinn that this invitation was pointing to. And so he knew that he was in some sort of trouble. And
yeah,
no, I don't know. That's anyway.
Yep. It's confusing. Mm-hmm. This is also just so we don't miss another movie, because he still references this essentially. And Then There Were None, the Agatha Christie novel / film. This whole episode is based around that. And it's interesting that it comes on the heels of the last episode, because both of them are structurally very similar. They're stuck alone together amid a group of eccentric suspects as a killer comes after them. And they have to figure out, it's another whodunit in a contained space. They can't leave. Mm-hmm. So back to back with In the Steel of the Night, it feels kind of almost like a retread. Mm-hmm. But obviously there are some differences, and it is very Agatha Christie in this sense.
And it does become a more direct reference later in the episode, of course. Okay, so after the little kind of a prequel or the introductory scene in the doctor's office, we're back at the Steel Agency office, and Steel is really pushing, especially after he hears the words resort,
yep,
island, and presumably island, the name Devil's Playground. He's really anxious to go and get Laura there.
I don't wonder if he's got a subscription.
You know, that does come up later, because he does make some reference about reading it for the articles. The articles, which is, yeah, that's.
But that's another Playboy reference, right? Because everybody who had Playboy would say, "Oh no! I've got it for the articles."
Yes.
Yeah.
So yeah, he's really anxious to get Laura there, and he asks Bernice to go get him a medical bag, and he references Robert Young.
Yep.
I guess at this time, probably a lot of people would have still made the connection. Maybe not so much anymore. Robert Young was an actor who played in a TV show that ran for like 8 years called Marcus Welby, M.D. Mm. And he was with a young actor named James Brolin. I don't know if you ever heard of him or not.
I have. I wonder if he's any relation to Josh Brolin.
James Brolin is the father of Josh Brolin.
Well, there we go. Solving mysteries one minute at a time.
Yes. And James Brolin's wife, at least at the time of Josh's birth, was a lady named Barbara Streisand.
Oh, wow.
Some people might know her name.
Yeah, she's marginally known.
Mm-hmm. Marginally.
Yeah, just a little bit.
So that was a reference to the Marcus Welby TV show. And so for anybody who didn't quite understand that reference about the bag and Robert Young, that was it. Robert Young was also known as a father character for
the
TV show Father Knows Best.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That I did know. I knew that one.
But what about this whole scene in general? Murphy's reaction of...
It's getting away from us again. That is a great line.
You know, and Steele saying, but Laura, you're curious. You're curious. You want to know.
Yeah. This is a really interesting part, because this is a very thin argument. The going to the island, impersonating the client to find out if his death wasn't it is a suicide. They know it's a suicide. There's no mystery here. There's no, you know.
Other than perhaps
there's no
why.
Case, right? Except why. So, and we never find that out, of course.
We never find out the solution to that mystery.
But Laura, she agrees pretty much on the spot to go. And Murphy, of course, her argument to Murphy is like, do you really want him to go off on his own impersonating her client? And that's sort of her reasoning. But when he says it's getting away from us again, Steele immediately says, you're as curious about this as I am. And at this point, it's almost like they're the angel and devil on her shoulders, like in the cartoons. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if she agrees because she wants to be alone with him. She says something later on to the effect of, you know, I was curious at how this was going to go. And or if there is some truth that she is afraid of what might happen if he goes off on his own, just given what happened in the last episode. And it's also kind of worth pointing out that this is episode 10 and they've kissed once, and it was in Steel Waters Run Deep. And of course that they had plausible deniability. So
yes,
they've flirted, they've addressed the fact that they're interested in one another. Nothing's come of it. So the fact that she's willing to just sort of go off on this getaway is a big deal. And neither one of them think to invite Murphy along. Steele's like, yes, let's go to this island. She's like, I'll pack my bag. Goodbye. And Murphy's just sitting there, and poor Murphy. He accuses Steele of just trying to get her alone on an island. He smirks and says he's very perceptive. That's kind of, the ruse is so flimsy.
Yeah.
I just think that this has to be Laura's curiosity getting the better of her, both maybe about the client and about Steele.
Well, going back to the term, one of our catchphrases, plausible deniability. Yeah. Her excuse for it is legitimate sounding. And yeah. I really like the way she says it. You alluded to it, but you didn't quite catch the full context and the fullness of the quote. It's, if I allow him to go out there on his own, impersonating Remington Steele, he's impersonating one person who is impersonating another person. Yeah. So it's, yeah. And it's like, can you imagine the outcome? So, I mean, she has a legitimate sounding excuse.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
But you're right. She is so eager to go. It seems apparent that it is just that. It's just an excuse. It's not the reason.
Yeah.
It's just the excuse. If you understand my difference there.
Because she doesn't try to talk him out of it.
No.
In previous episodes, she would have tried to talk him out of it. Thinking of Etched in Steel, she smelled a case. And then when she no longer smelled it, she was trying to put him out. Like, there's been times where they've made an effort to redirect him, as futile as it's been. But she doesn't do that here. She's just like, yep, cool. I'll get my stuff.
And I think Murphy's feeling like he's been outmaneuvered because there's obviously no real case. As you said.
No.
He committed suicide. It's not disputable. Maybe there's a little bit of a mystery as to why, but that's really not their function.
No, they're not getting paid for it.
And Steele has just taken advantage of the situation to get her out alone, away from Murphy.
Yeah.
And Murphy just, he wasn't in a position to have any kind of response to counter that and to make a play for the situation himself.
No. No, it's not like he could have said, okay, I'll get my stuff as well, especially after making a big deal out of why it wasn't worth looking into. Like, Steele would have just argued that it was one person too many. Oh, you're not, you know, we don't want to take you away from such valuable work.
And so I think Murphy's starting to feel, I think he's starting to realize that he's been benched, basically. Yeah. He's on the second team now.
He's kind of fighting a losing battle.
Yeah. Okay, so next they show up on the island, and Laura wants to be known as Tracy Lord, which, if you do an internet search, gets ugly.
Because you just don't want to put the S on her last name.
Even if you don't, it tends to want to redirect you to an adult movie actress a similar name.
It's funny because I wonder if this is why, because the name is from the Philadelphia Story as well. That's the name Katharine Hepburn uses in the film. But I kind of wonder if that's why they picked
Katharine Hepburn, James Stewart, 1940.
I wonder if this is why they picked this film and this name for Laura to latch onto, because it had that connection that obviously kind of connects to the theme of the episode, which is the adult industry.
I don't know.
Oh, no, wait. I don't think she was doing that at this point. No, it wouldn't have actually because I happen to know a little bit about the actress because she was in an episode of Highlander, the series, and that was in the 90s, and that was before she sort of switched over to her other career. So, yeah, I think this is just a really happy coincidence, but I could be wrong. I don't know that much about her other profession.
Well, this other Tracy was born in 1968, so
she could have been, I guess, yeah.
She could have just been in the early stages of her career.
Hmm.
And if I had to make a guess, I would guess that the actress of a similar name actually picked that name based on the Katharine Hepburn character.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, that's true.
But. Yeah, so Laura wants to be known as Tracy Lord, as you said, from the Philadelphia Story, Cary Grant, Katharine Hepburn, James Stewart, MGM 1940. And then they meet this really weird assortment of characters.
Oh, yes, they are so starting strange. With
Cindy Sykes. Hi, I'm Miss May. No, not Miss May. I'm Miss May. I guess I guess they needed the stereotypical airhead.
Yep.
Blonde airhead at that.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, she didn't really do much for me.
No. Although I do think it's interesting. The first thing that she does when she finds out he's a, quote, doctor is ask him for birth control. And I kind of wondered what the reasoning is behind this, because I looked into some of the attitudes toward birth control in the 80s because I knew that the pill, having access to the pill in and of itself, was relatively new in the sense that it had only been made available to unmarried women for 10 years since 1972. And I mean, Loretta Lynn, who passed away recently, even wrote a song about it. And it was somewhat taboo all the way through the 70s, but eventually attitudes started changing, moving into the 80s. The AIDS crisis had a big impact on that. And I kind of wonder if, I don't think it was a political reason that they put it in there, but I just wonder if it was sort of evidencing the change of attitude towards sexual health and you know, like, she's clearly somebody that is, she's a bunny, essentially, and a Playboy bunny, but she's, at least in this one area, being kind of smart about it, asking if he's got any birth control. So I don't know. It's just an odd thing to, or I wonder if it was just put in there to hint that she's promiscuous. I don't know.
I think there's probably a couple of things. One, to show that she's an airhead because, oh, you forgot your birth control pills and you're going to a place that's, you know, essentially an equivalent to the Playboy Mansion, where presumably you're going to engage in various horizontal activities. So I think there was part of that. And I think also that is kind of an acknowledgement that that's what goes on in these places.
Yeah.
Let's face it. The Playboy Mansion was kind of known between the pseudo philanthropic events that they held there. It was known as kind of a sex hangout, I think. So I think there's all of this is tied up into it. And it's not necessarily meant as social commentary as much as it's just, this is the setting. These are the characters. These are the behaviors that we would expect out of them. So let's have them behave the way that we would expect to have them behave.
Yeah, I don't think it was meant as social. I think it was just sort of unintended in the sense that it sort of shows, like, when this was made, that's what she would ask, you know, oh, do you have any birth control? You're right. It was like an intention of showing that this is what this place is meant for, essentially. A sort of what we call, I guess, cinematic shorthand way of getting you there.
Yeah. And then we meet Madeline Vickers, the piano player who doesn't take requests.
No. She's really, for a quote unquote musician, she's really hostile to everybody. No wonder her albums didn't sell.
Well, you know, and the other thing is that presumably she followed kind of a similar route to a lot of musicians.
Yeah.
And we find out later that she had some help in the recording aspects of it. But in terms of general expected path for a lounge piano player, they're going to be in a position where they're going to get a lot of requests.
Yep, true.
And it probably doesn't do your career a whole lot of good to say, no, I don't do requests.
Yeah. It's like a DJ that doesn't, you know, same thing, right? You're not going to get
hired. Yeah, which is actually how a lot of radio stations went in the last, I don't know what, since the late 90s or so, where so much of their system was automated that they had a request line.
Yeah, screws everything up.
It didn't do anything. I mean, you called in, you made your request to somebody who might not have been in the room. They might have been in the control room, but they weren't a DJ. There was maybe no actual DJ there. All the bits were pre-recorded, and it was just, okay, these are the songs. We do them in order because it's all timed out. And guess what? That song's going to come up eventually, and then they're going to think that they got their request fulfilled.
Their request is played. That's true. Yeah.
Randy Russell. Randy, that's comforting to know.
Especially on these long weekends. I think that's probably my favorite double entendre in the episode. I'm Randy. It's comforting to know.
Well, Feldman comes up with another, sets up another one that's pretty good, too.
And yeah, that's
true. He mentions that he's got a brother who's a proctologist, and Steele says, interesting area.
Interesting area. Yeah, that was a good one, too.
And then, of course, Steele introduces Laura as Myrtle Groggins. Where did he come up with that
name? I Googled it because I wondered if it had a film reference, and I could not find anything. So I have no idea where he came up with it, but it's pretty funny. And it's He also introduces her as his current inamorata, which is a very funny way of saying lover, I guess. Yes.
Which, of course, sets up a scene later on.
Yeah. And then he insists, call her Myrtle.
Yeah.
So it's not just that he's made her angry. He's poking the bear.
Yes. But why? Why would you do that if you're trying to create a romantic situation? Why would you deliberately antagonize somebody by, A, choosing a name that you know they're going to hate?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Especially once they've expressed an interest in a particular name, and then rub it in.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, it's one of those things where it seems like he's trying to sabotage himself at the same time he's trying to set himself up. It's
so that's actually, when we get there, that was actually one of my theories, that he's subconsciously self-sabotaging.
Okay. Well, as the scene goes on, Randy comes up and asks,
impressive,
you want to do it, doctor? Yeah. And then, and you know exactly what he's looking at when she's walking away. And it's not the mansion.
Nope.
You know, this episode is one of those that gets really, really close to
it being
one of the most risque episodes they've ever done.
It walks the line, because there's some stuff that comes up later as well that's pretty, we'll get there.
And this is where Steele makes the reference that he does read Devil Magazine for the occasional article.
For the occasional article.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was just part of the character, right? Because Arthur Bellows would have been expected to be a Devil Magazine connoisseur if he's there on the island for the weekend. So I kind of wonder, does Steele actually have a subscription, or is it one where he's just putting it on as part of his character?
And that's what I had down here, is, does he really read Devil Magazine for the occasional article, or is it just part of his cover? It could be either one. Certainly, it works well as part of the cover. It is, as you say, something that would be expected of Dr. Arthur Bellows.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it makes sense as part of the cover. Now, the interesting thing, you mentioned Playboy.
Yep.
I think there are actually people out there who did read Playboy Magazine for the articles, because they did have articles and fiction and other things written by some of the leading literary figures, and interviews with some of the leading cultural, entertainment, political figures of the day.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I never actually got my hands on a magazine, but later on, as the internet became a thing, you could find some of those articles, right? Like, they could. I remember being linked to a couple of them on different topics and reading them and going, oh, so there really is articles, like, because I didn't know.
Well, it was in Playboy magazine where Jimmy Carter admitted, I have lusted in my heart.
Yeah.
So, they did have some big names appear in those magazines.
Which is interesting. And I think Pierce Brosnan even did an interview in one of them.
He may have. It wouldn't be a surprise. Now, the other thing is that we find out that Madeline had a record contract that Ambrose had set up a record label for her and let her record a record, and then closed up the label because he, as he said, couldn't give her records away.
Yeah.
That's kind of another tie-in to Playboy.
Yep.
Many people are not aware of the fact that Playboy actually had a record division since the mid-1950s.
Yeah.
And some interesting things about that label. The first two ABBA singles released in the U.S., although not under the name ABBA, they were as Bjorn and Benny with Anna and Frida.
Oh, interesting. Were
released on Playboy.
Huh. I did not know that.
Barbie Benton, who was probably most famous for being a Playboy bunny, Hugh Hefner's girlfriend.
Right.
And also appearing on the TV show Hee Haw, released albums on that label. Mickey Gilley, huge country star, Mickey Gilley, 7 albums on the Playboy record label. Hamilton Joe Franken Reynolds, also known as Hamilton Joe Franken Dennison, 2 top 40 hits on Playboy Records. And also an early Hudson Brothers album was released under the name of Hudson on Playboy. So, and Al Wilson, who previous to having a release on Playboy had a huge hit with a song called Show and Tell. So they had some names on their label. Then they had a bunch of nobody artists, and they did a bunch of various artist albums. And eventually the label folded.
Right.
Because they couldn't get the distribution and the hits and the profit from it. So they shut it down. But again, there's another tie-in to, another allusion to Playboy.
Huh. That's really interesting. Because I mean, I knew there was a record label, but I didn't realize how many well-known names were, you know, they had been affiliated with.
Well, back in the 50s, when they first started releasing records, they were various artist albums, and they had some big name jazz artists appear on those various artist records. So yeah, they were kind of a weird oddball label, that's for sure. After dinner, they're having, before dinner, they're having cocktails. So Steele, again, in the case of overacting.
Yeah.
A man in my profession must be exceedingly careful with alcoholic spirits are concerned, young lady. However, the judicious use of alcoholic spirits is actually a tonic for the body. I'll have a cocktail or two now, a flagon of wine with the meal, an after-dinner drink, followed by some Irish coffee. I might have to operate in the morning.
Yeah, and then he says, Laura says something like pouring it on a bit thick, and he says, Laura, the man's a hopeless alcoholic. You know, you're hopeless, all right.
I mean, that's another one of those cases of Steele taking something that he imagines to be true and taking the Hollywood hype and overacting and then doing it himself.
Yep.
I'm sorry. Even the most alcoholics of doctors wouldn't be so blatantly obvious about it.
No, you wouldn't. Especially not someone who had that many malpractice suits levied against him. You wouldn't think they would want anyone to know that they drink.
Yeah, which is one of the reasons why vodka is apparently so popular.
Yeah.
Because supposedly you can't tell from the smell or whatever. But
nope.
I don't know.
You can't. I will say nothing else of my youth, and we'll just leave it at that. So, yeah.
Later on, outside of their room, Laura and Steele are starting their argument. Mm-hmm. This is an argument that really takes place over much of the rest of the episode.
There's three separate places in it. Yeah.
And it starts out where she's upset, obviously, about Myrtle.
Dull, plotting, realistic.
And that's his excuse. Tracy would have sounded manufactured.
I mean, he just went through this whole song and dance to make him look out to be like the most alcohol-soaked surgeon.
You mean ever. Something that sounded manufactured?
Yeah, exactly. And then he's like, oh, Tracy would have sounded way too unrealistic. When you look it up, Tracy's one of the most popular names in the 80s. But okay, sure.
Well, of course, it wouldn't have been the 80s. It would have been the 50s.
No, but well, I mean, yeah.
But yeah, it's Randy. Okay, definitely made up. Cindy, maybe a bit made up. But Tracy, Tracy's less so.
Not.
And then, of course, the argument continues in their room, and Steele he seems to be impressed with the decor. And obviously, she's not.
Yeah. She calls it something out of a cheap adult movie.
Yeah, like some cheap, gaudy adult motel. Yes.
Yeah.
And
it's pretty hideous. It looks like they're sleeping inside a bottle of Pepto-Bismol. I would not want to be sleeping in that room.
It looks like the worst set designer got hired to do a movie, and they were given this description. It's an adult motel, as Laura references here, and this is what came out.
Yeah. Oof, it's bad. And
I wondered, her comment, it's disgusting, it's like some cheap, gaudy adult motel. Is that based on personal experience? I presume not, or professional experience as a detective, or is it, again, just somebody's idea? In this case, her idea of what a cheap, gaudy adult motel would look like based on Hollywood or whatever.
Good question. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, because I haven't seen those kinds of movies. Mm-hmm. I assume that's kind of what it would look like. That would be my assumption. I don't know if it's one of those like assumptions that get made by the general public.
Well, that's certainly how those types of places are portrayed in mainstream films, you know, where if it's a movie deals with somebody going to an adult motel, that's how it's portrayed. But is that the reality? I don't know.
That's
and
a good question.
Of course, I also had written down here that it is certainly overdone and somewhat gaudy, but is it really as bad as she thinks? Or is she responding to Steele's manipulations?
I think it's both. I think it's ugly.
Yes. Oh, that's not a question.
I don't think if they were both in the same place and they were both like headspace wise and they were both, she wasn't royally pissed off at him. I think that she could have looked past it. I think she would have rolled her eyes maybe, but I think it wouldn't have been as much of an issue as it is now. She's mad. She's big mad. And so everything is amplified.
Makes sense. Well, and then of course it's kind of redirected in a couple of minutes because after she leaves the room angry, Randy comes in and does her body by bellows.
Body by Bellows, which is, of course, a reference. There's a few references. Body by Victoria, because Victoria's Secret has a bra line, Body by Victoria. And there was also, now I don't know if these existed in the 80s, but there's a one of those multi-level marketing companies, Body by Vi, where you can buy like milkshakes and apparently get Vi's body. I don't know what Vi's body looks like, but apparently we want it. So,
so after Randy leaves, Laura comes back in, and Steele says, well, she thinks I renovated her. And Laura is just, I don't want to say that the claws are out, but she's certainly vicious.
Oh, they're out.
She was a patient of Arthur Bellows, and she doesn't know you're a fraud. They must have thrown in a lobotomy at no extra charge.
But she's not wrong. I mean, theoretically, if this was a, I mean, we know Randy is the villain, but if it were the case where Randy was legitimately a patient and didn't recognize him, that would have been my observation too. Like, why didn't she recognize you then if you've operated on her?
You know, at this point, she does come off as kind of a brunette version of Cindy.
Yeah.
You know, kind of the airhead.
She very much does, which of course we know is a facade, right. But yeah. Well, we don't know it yet, but we know it at the end.
Now, in the dinner scene coming up, there's a reference here that I don't quite fully understand because it's not a movie reference directly, and maybe not even indirectly, maybe very obtusely. It's Laura's comment, Franks and Beans on Wedgwood, Shades of Citizen Hearst. It seems to be a reference to the Hearst publisher empire, William Randolph Hearst. And so I looked it up and I didn't see anything that suggested that he was an eccentric who would have a meal of Franks and Beans on high-end China dinnerware. And I thought, well, maybe it's a reference to Citizen Kane, which is actually a movie loosely based on Hearst, but I didn't see a reference in that movie to anything like this either. So I'm not sure what the reference is.
It's an obscure one for sure, because Citizen Kane, as you said, was loosely based on William Randolph Hearst. And William Randolph Hearst created the largest newspaper, magazine, newsreel, movie business. Mm-hmm. And then
I mean, he was kind of like the Facebook of the time, in a sense, because he was into all these media technologies and formats.
Right.
But I didn't see anything that suggested that he was an eccentric like this.
No.
So I don't know.
I don't know. It's
an obscure reference. Maybe somebody out there knows. So then they have the appearance of Ambrose via videotape, which then comes into play later on. And then they're back up at the room and the argument, the fight continues.
So can we just back up for just a second? Because there's another sort of Playboy reference here in the sense that Feldman looks at Cindy and Randy, who are laughing together, and says, you know, quite a pair, aren't they? And Laura replies, so I've heard, which is another really funny double entendre. And then he proceeds to tell her that Randy was Ambrose's main woman, so essentially a reference to the head bunny. And once upon a time, there was a reality show of some sort about the Playboy Mansion. I didn't watch it, but I know I saw a few interviews from some of the key bunnies, and there was always like a head bunny, and then there was other bunnies, I guess. So Randy is clearly was the head bunny, and I guess now Cindy is the head bunny, and that was another direct sort of Playboy. Although I don't know if that all of that would have been known at this point, but
this would have been about the time that I think Barbie Benton had been replaced probably by somebody else. So that could have been kind of an obtuse reference to Barbie Benton because there are some physical similarities between the two.
Yeah.
So that could be. So anyway, they're back up in the room and the argument continues and it's Steele is just, like you said, he's just poking the bear on this one. One pillar or two, Myrtle, my pet.
Oh, you moron. You moron. Like, you just want to smack him because he was so close. She accuses him of manipulating her there under false pretense, and he calls her on it by pointing out that they both knew there wasn't really a case and that she wanted to come just as much as he did. And then her response, "That's right, I did," makes it very clear that his actions have caused her to rethink things.
Yeah, I'm not going to say that he didn't manipulate her to get there. But yeah, she was more than willing to go. I mean, it wasn't like he really had to twist her arm.
No, she's not stupid. She knew why he wanted to follow this non-existent case.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he couldn't just let things evolve.
No.
He had to introduce her as his girlfriend to make sure that, as Laura says, to make sure they'd end up in the same room.
Yep.
And, you know, if you were so certain that I wanted to be here, why did you have to maneuver me into this room? And she's got a point. Of course, he says, "I was hedging my bet."
Yep.
You know, "I never know where I stand with you."
Which is fair, although his comment about his desire getting the better of his innate honesty is rather amusing.
Which innate honesty is that?
Yeah, exactly. Where is that? We haven't seen that yet. I don't think he intentionally sabotaged himself, but I think somewhere deep down he's aware that a change in their physical relationship would be different from other people he's been involved with, maybe more of a big deal than he originally thought, especially after that conversation they have in the car in Signed, Sealed, and Delivered. And so I wonder if this is the first time that he's really starting to understand that feelings are at stake. I don't think he expected to get anywhere with her. I think he wanted to, but I think deep down he maybe didn't think it was going to happen. And I think he's maybe subconsciously sabotaged it.
I'm wondering about this line. "I never know where I stand with you. All this never mixing business with pleasure business." I'm wondering if he's just falling back on his old routine.
Yeah.
Because of that. It's okay. So you don't want to mix business with pleasure. Maybe you do. Maybe you don't. You can't quite make up your mind. You say one thing one time, another thing another time. So tried and true method. It's worked for me in the past.
Yep.
It's a lousy pickup line, but it's worked. So,
well, kind of like a playing the numbers game.
Yeah.
You use the same line on 10 women and maybe one of them falls for it and hey, it worked. Yeah. But I think you're right. Like, I think Laura has up until this point sort of run hot and cold when it comes to him, and he's not sure where he stands. And this was, as you say, like him kind of falling back on what he knows how to do.
And maybe trying to force the situation, force a confrontation, force a decision.
Mm-hmm. Could be, yeah. I mean, if they argue about it, at least they're talking about it. Whereas Laura is prone to avoiding it. She's prone to sort of not overtly saying that this is what she's... This is the first time she's explicitly, aside from when he first says jump in the sack and she says love to, this is the first time she's probably explicitly said that she wanted to be here with him under these particular circumstances. She even says, you know how much fun it would have been sneaking into each other's rooms. You know, she hasn't at this point, she's hinted, but she hasn't come out and said, like, this is what I wanted to be here with you. And
that's about as close as she's going to get without actually saying it.
Yeah. And she also says to him, like, everything's an angle with you. There's no straight line. But I don't think he knows how to do the straight line thing because, as you said, this is his pattern. He knows that this works and this is what he's always had success with. So he's kind of just...
There's never been a straight line with him because he's never been in a situation where a straight line was appropriate because it's always been a con.
Yeah.
And B, he doesn't even know where the line begins because he doesn't even know really who he is.
No, I think you're right. Yeah, he's still figuring that out.
It was definitely not a good move, but I guess I can understand why he did that. But, you know, the thing is, even though he winds up sleeping on the love seat, at least Laura let him stay in the room for the night.
I think it's this, and it's also worth pointing out that the minute Laura shuts down the potential that they're going to sleep together, he not only respects her, he doesn't push it. He argues about other aspects of the relationship, but he never pushes that boundary specifically. And as you said, like she lets him stay in the room. He kisses her goodnight after she's asleep. Like that's a very gentle, sort of tender action. And it clearly shows that his feelings are beyond infatuation, that he's not harboring any. He might be a little sexually frustrated, but he's not angry with her. I think he sort of sees where she's coming from and realizes he screwed up. I did like his, this is beginning to resemble a honeymoon line, but you know, I don't think he's bitter about it in the sense that, you know, oh, how dare she turn me down. I think he gets it.
Yeah, I think he does. The next morning, Cindy's found dead, tickled to death. Tickled to death. Seriously? That's the best, most rational explanation you can come up with, Remington Steele, for explaining this woman's death.
Well, he's not a real doctor. He just plays one on TV.
He's also not a real detective. He just plays one on TV.
He just plays one on TV. Yeah.
And I think later on, they come up with a plausible explanation for being tickled to death. But
Feldman does.
I mean, still, in that situation, why couldn't you at least come up with something that seemed a little more plausible out of the gate?
Yeah, true. I think it was maybe also meant to show his, because he's, you know, they're looking at it. This is what gets me. Here's my question. When they find her, immediately Randy says she's dead before they even go up to her. She could have just been asleep, right? Like, they didn't even check her pulse. And we know Randy is the murderer, so obviously she knows. But, like, nobody thinks anything of that. She just says she's dead, and they all kind of buy into it. And then Feldman asks Steele how she died. And I find it odd that nobody questions, A, how Randy knew she was dead, or B, how they think Steele could just tell how she died by looking at her. Laura's the one that points out cause of death can't be determined without an autopsy. But
and he is probably about as unqualified as Feldman's brother-in-law.
Exactly.
Because he's supposedly a plastic surgeon.
Yeah. Yeah. That's not even his area. Like, he's not a coroner. He can't just, you know, and this is another thing that when you find her, those feathers are very strategically placed. Like, this is probably the most skin you see on this show of any character. So there's it gets a bit risque there too. Like, she's barely covered.
Well, as long as it's covered, I guess.
I guess.
So after that, they decide they need to find Ambrose Blinn.
Yep.
Randy and Steele go out looking for him and find him. And then, of course, this is where we get the direct reference to the movie, And Then There Was None.
Yep.
This sets up a situation later, and I'm going to go ahead and ask this now.
Sure.
Because it is as appropriate here as it is later. If he is correct, and if he is as much of a movie fan as he's supposed to be, how could he not remember a key point in the plot?
Yeah, that's what I wondered.
Because this is going to come up later.
Yeah.
And he's already recognized that this is the situation they're in.
Yep. He does. He misses that big time.
Yeah.
I also think it's interesting, and this movie had not come out yet, but if you've ever seen the movie Seven, which came out in the 90s, a killer is murdering people. A serial killer is murdering people according to what he believes them guilty of, the seven deadly sins. So the manner of their death corresponds with the sin that they're supposedly guilty of. So there's a character who literally has his stomach explode. It's very gross. Because he's supposed to be gluttonous, right? And there's a prostitute that gets murdered. She's supposed to be lust. And this kind of made me think of that. I mean, obviously, again, Seven hadn't come out yet, so this is not an attempt at referencing it, but Cindy was, you know, prone to hysterically irritating laughter, and she was supposedly tickled to death, and then Blinn was choked to death with garbage. So they're sort of being killed in the means of their whatever their personality deficits.
Their death is being used as a commentary on their,
yes, exactly, their
failures. Yeah, makes sense. So, yeah, as you said, he was choked to death on garbage. And, of course, they find the videotape. And then they find out, yeah, this really is an And Then There Were None situation. No phones, no lights, not a single luxury. Like Robinson. Oh, sorry, wrong show. But, you know, no phones, no radio, no TV, shortwave. Even the electricity is running on emergency power. Why don't they just all go sit in one room and sit there until something happens and somebody shows up to get them?
Or it's pointed out later on that the killer would have had a way off the island. why don't they clue into that here and start looking for a boat?
Well, but again, that requires people going off in small groups of one or two.
Yeah.
Unless you want to try and herd cats and have everybody walk together looking for it, which is kind of silly.
That's what they did in the last episode.
Well, that's true. But it just seems to me that at this point, you know what's going on. You've already identified the movie that is being copied here. Just everybody sit together in a room and hold hands, sing kumbaya, and don't move. Yeah, until somebody shows up.
Spin the bottle. Whatever you got to do.
Yes.
I want to know what the honey thing is. I'm just going to put that out there.
I was wondering. Yeah, I've got that written down next. I was debating on whether to go with that or not because I don't know what the honey thing is.
I don't, especially not with walnuts.
I tried to find the honey thing. Yeah, with the walnuts and such. It's like,
because here's where my mind went with this, okay? And I'm going to try not to get into too much detail, but like putting honey anywhere intimate would cause infections. So what are you doing, especially with walnuts?
Yeah, because the walnuts would tend to be a little bit irritating.
I would think, yeah. Heat it and add, he says, are you familiar with the honey thing? And then he goes on to say, you take a bowl of honey, heat it and add half a pound of shredded walnuts. That is an awful lot of walnuts that you're putting in this heated honey. So this is one of those things where they never had any sort of answer to, this is the unexplained murder. The bullet came from out inside the body. Because
you know, the only thing I can think of that might be honey and walnuts would be something you'd put on your pancakes.
Yeah,
instead of ketchup.
They're not putting it on their pancakes, I don't think.
No, that must be some pancake. So
this is taking a turn.
So the tensions are rising. Everybody's accusing everybody else of everything.
Yep.
There's a great line that comes up. Randy and Dominic are going at it. She's accusing him of trying to kill her. And Steele comes up and says, let's confine ourselves to name calling. It's far more civilized. It's
far more civilized. I had that written down too. I like that one.
And then, of course, they decide Laura's got to die. Okay, so they're going right back to the movie that they already know the plot of. They already know that the person who dies in the movie is the killer.
Yep.
Or that the killer fakes their death in the movie. So if they already know that this is the movie they're dealing with and one of them is the killer is not going to buy it. Why are they even trying this?
They're going to know. And even Laura says that. She says the death has to look like an accident, but still, come on. You accidentally die when somebody's already picking people off one by one. Like that just, no.
Yeah. I mean, okay, they are smart enough to know that the killer would know that they didn't do it and that it would have to look like an accident. But isn't that too much of a coincidence to be a coincidence? Yeah, I mean, that seems
way too much.
Yeah.
And can we also point out that Steele is a peeping Tom in both of these scenes? This one and the one before, he's peeking in at Laura in the bathroom through the keyhole. Of course, this time she finds him. She opens the door and he's, I'm searching for a cufflink. Yeah. I found it. Here it is. And then, are you wearing pantyhose? Yes. Why? Strip. Like, there's a lot in this episode that is walking a line.
And then, of course, obviously, it doesn't work after he announces that Myrtle Groggins is dead.
Myrtle's Laura Groggins.
Yes. And then, of course, there is an actual attempt on her life. And the brilliant deduction. Somebody else saw the movie.
Yeah.
Well, no, duh.
And here's my question. This is, again, another add on, maybe a similar question to the one from the last episode. He makes a comment about running out of rooms later on, but like, where is Laura? Like, where did he lay her down? Did he lay her down in their room or her room or wherever? And if so, like, is Cindy's body still in the bedroom? I don't think it is, because when they were looking through her room, she wasn't there. So where are they putting the bodies?
That's a good question. Laura is, from what I can see, she is back in the room that they were sharing.
Yeah, it seems like that. But then, obviously, he would be expected to sleep somewhere else. Yeah. Unless he's,
Unless, don't go there.
I'm not gonna judge. You do you.
I would say that Cindy's probably in her room. I would think that they put Blynn in his room, assuming they didn't move him from, or assuming they didn't leave him from where he was at.
Yeah, maybe they just left him out there. Also, he carries her up the stairs. He lays her down on the bed and makes a comment that she's putting on a bit of weight. Where? This is the second time. Where?
I don't know.
The writers are sort of obsessed with implying that, like, okay.
She's not. No, she's not. It's definitely not overweight. If anything, one could even make the argument she's slightly underweight. But
yeah,
but
she's tiny. No.
Yeah. Well, of course, the shot was made mm-hmm. at Laura. Didn't work. And Remington Steele reveals his identity.
Yep.
And yeah, perhaps you've heard of me. No. He's just getting kicked in his ego as far as his supposed identity.
He needs that.
Yes. And then, of course, Madeline ends up dead.
Yep.
So it's continuing, and they realize that none of their plan worked.
Nope.
And then they wind up back in the bedroom.
Yep.
And they're continuing.
This is part two. Argument part two. Well, not really an argument, I guess. More of a discussion.
It's calmed down.
Yeah.
It's definitely taken a turn toward the more rational type of discussion. Laura kind of admits that she might be confusing her fictional creation with the man standing in front of her.
Yeah.
She says, maybe I created an impossible role for anyone to play.
Yeah. This is probably the first time that they really discuss what they want from one another. He tells her he's trying to be honest. She actually hesitates in letting him tell her too much. She doesn't want to know if he's already married or I think you'd want to know if he killed someone, period, regardless of whether or not you're in a relationship. But hey, that's just but she goes on. Yeah. She says, I don't want to know. I don't want to know unless we cross that line. I don't want to know. But then it also sets up a bit of a catch-22 because she's hesitant to even get that far without knowing where she stands. And then when he tries to kind of be honest, she's like, nah, I actually don't want to know. So this is very much like where she's kind of running hot and cold.
Yeah. It's back to what he said earlier about, I never know where I stand with you because you've got this rule. And then sometimes you don't want the rule. And then other times you do. And same thing you're talking about here. She wants to know about his past, but when the opportunity comes for her to learn it, because he's willing to divulge some.
When he's willing to share.
It's like, I can't handle it. No, don't tell me.
And I think she knows because if he gives, right, it's one of those things where both of them aren't budging from this place they've entrenched themselves in. And if he takes a step forward and offers up the thing that she's kind of been wanting from him, then I don't want to say she's going to have to, because nobody really has to, but she's going to feel obligated. It's the wrong
word. He's calling her bluff.
Yeah.
He's calling her bluff because she is, as you said, set up a situation that's a no-win situation. She insists he tell her about himself and then won't let him. And if he manages to get some of it out, she no longer has an excuse, because the excuse half the time is, well, you won't tell me anything about your past, so how can we go forward? Okay, well, I just told you. Okay, now what do I do?
It's the relationship Kobayashi Maru.
No-win scenario.
I don't believe in no-win scenario. Oh, nerd. But you're right.
Sorry, folks. It is
Star Trek rears its ugly head. But and then she goes on to describe the qualities that she gave Remington Steele, and he makes the comment of, it sounds like you're destined to be endlessly disappointed in me. And then you're right. She admits that maybe she created someone impossible to match, like the fantasy and the reality. But I would argue that he does have integrity. He does have compassion and a desire to help others. Honesty comes and goes, but like, he has the other parts of his personality, and she's seen those elements of his personality. So,
well, and it's the fact that the honesty comes and goes that really complicates those other things. Yeah, true. I mean, it complicates his integrity, because he's got integrity, but it's tied up with his honesty. And if his honesty is going out the window for some situation, is he showing integrity at that point? You could argue in a weird kind of way he is, but he's not really. He is caring and compassionate, except when his honesty goes out the window and he's trying to manipulate Laura into a weekend getaway where she's feels obligated to compromise herself simply because she seems to have been painted into a corner. So I can understand where she's coming across on this.
Yeah.
But I still think, based on his comment, sounds as if you're destined to be endlessly disappointed in me. And her comment in response, maybe I created an impossible role for anyone to play. I think that somewhere she's got to get her head straight and understand that Remington Steele, the fiction, and Remington Steele, the man, are not the same thing, and stop trying to superimpose the fiction over the real man and then blaming him for not living up to her fantasy.
Yeah.
Because that's essentially what she's doing.
It is. And we get the feeling she's using it as a barrier between intimacy, right? She's got this idea in her head of the perfect man, and there's no perfect man. There's no perfect
anybody. Do you know who you're talking to?
Oh, sorry.
I'm sorry. That noise you hear in the background, that's my wife laughing.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, it's true because she's set the bar so high.
Yes.
As a way of making sure that she never has to meet him at that same point. And in this particular scene, he's very honest with her when he says that commitment is something he's spent his whole life avoiding. He doesn't come out and say anything's changed on that, but his actions do. And Laura doesn't know how to trust actions. She only trusts words, right? So I think he's doing his best to be honest with her, but he's obviously not at the point where his honesty is where she wants it to be. And even when he attempts to offer it to her, that scares her because, if he's making an attempt, then I might not have an excuse.
And to, I don't want to throw his comment back at him. He says, I've spent a better part of my life avoiding those things like the proverbial plague, the commitment. Laura has spent her life since Mr. White Belts avoiding those things like the proverbial plague. Bankers do it with interest. Yes. So they're both trying to avoid it.
Yeah.
Anyway, so now they go out the next morning to find Randy's dead.
But I have one other question before they find out Randy's dead. He tells her to sleep well. Mm-hmm. Why are they not sleeping in shifts? There's a murder on the premises. Like, they both go to bed.
And there's already been one attempt on her life.
Yeah. Like, do they assume that the murderer is just going to, like, take the night off because they got to sleep too? Like, it's just kind of funny that they just sort of assume that they're safe while they're sleeping. And
good point.
You know, sleep well. Like, maybe one of you should be awake while the other person, and then you switch. There's just a thought. Anyway, sorry. Keep going.
Do we know actually that he is going to sleep? We don't actually see him.
That's true.
Bed down. He's stretched out on the love seat. Maybe he is going to stay up and play guard all night. I guess we really don't know. It would be the smart thing to do.
It really would be. Yeah.
So next morning, they find Randy dead in sarcasm quotes.
Yep.
Again, shouldn't they realize that at this point, one of the dead people isn't dead?
Yeah, you would think.
Or maybe you'd not think. Dead. I mean, maybe one of them isn't dead. They know the movie.
Somebody saw the movie.
And, you know, the other thing is, if Randy's killing everybody off and it hadn't occurred to her to fake her own death, did Laura and Steele trying to fake her death give her the idea to fake her death? Maybe she wasn't intentionally parodying. Maybe she wasn't intentionally copying the movie in that respect, or wasn't going to copy the movie in that respect, but could they have given her the idea?
Well, I wonder, she has the digitalis leaf and the syringe. I did some Googling on that too, because I wondered if it was a real thing, if there really was such a thing that you could make somebody appear dead who wasn't actually dead. And from what I found, digitalis leaf is considered a poison, and it will kill you if it's administered in a large enough dose. So I'm wondering if she had attempted to like had brought it with her. If she didn't bring it with her to fake her own death, then she probably brought it with her to use on somebody else in a deadly form. To make it look like an overdose or something like that. But yeah, that's a good question as to whether or not she faked her death because she saw Laura do it and she knew it would help her avoid suspicion, or because it wouldn't have worked in the long run. As soon as she got off the island and somebody came and found that they were all dead and she was gone, she'd be a suspect. Unless, I guess maybe she could just claim she wasn't there to begin with.
And you know, that does bring up an interesting point because even if she didn't fake her death, or even if she did fake her death one way or the other, by the time they got down to the last two people, one of them would have killed the other one and then ultimately presumably been accused of all the other murders. But you're right. They would have started saying, well, okay, where's this one body? There's a body missing. And it would automatically start, or it should automatically start raising questions about why is this person's body missing? Maybe they really weren't dead. Maybe this person that appears to be the killer really isn't. So yeah, you're right. I mean, it's one of those things where it seems to make sense on paper, but when you actually start thinking about it, there's issues.
Like Ambrose's suicide, which is promptly forgotten about once they arrive.
So anyway, Feldman, Dominic, they are the last men standing. And they began accusing each other of being the murderer. And then it seems like Dominic's getting the better of the argument, except that Dominic's found dead and Feldman's
standing over the body. No.
Feldman is dead and Dominic's found over the body. And then he freaks out and Laura and Steele run back to the house. And isn't there something in movies about not going back into the house where people are getting killed?
It is always the worst choice. Like at this point, this is, if they didn't think of it before, at this point, one of them should have realized that whoever the killer is, they have a way off the island. We should be looking for a boat. I get that it's raining. I get that it's dark. But like, it's going to be equally as difficult for them to find you if you're on the move as opposed to sitting like a sitting duck in the house.
Yeah. And if they're going to rely so much on movies as part of their cases, the movies teach you don't go back into the house.
Don't go into the house. Don't run up the stairs. Don't split up. Don't, like, there's a whole, have they not, I guess they haven't seen the Scream franchise because it hasn't come out yet. But, like, that lays out all the rules. Yes. They're not following any of the rules.
And then, of course, once they're in the house, the storm is hitting, and then they discover Dominic hanging. And
yeah, well, before they discover him, is this before when Steele attempts to do the trouble to the north, trouble to the south? His attempt at a confessional. Yeah, that's before it. He says that if we're not gonna make it out of here, there's some things I have to get off my chest and they might not be pleasant. So he warns her that he's gonna tell her some things about himself. They might not be pleasant. He says it was Dublin, and then she says, "Is that where you were born?" And then he said, "You know, Laura, please, these confessionals are hard enough." And then he goes into a city rife with unrest, trouble to the north, trouble to the south. And I wonder if this is, again, a genuine attempt at a confession. He's such a drama queen, so it kind of sounds dramatic. But, like, it also seems like he's genuinely trying to tell her something. But he's couching it in a way that's as dramatic as possible, maybe as a means of protecting himself. Like, I just thought this was sort of the finale to their sort of three-part discussion here. And then, of course, it gets interrupted by the shutter banging, and then they find Dominic.
I'm guessing he is going to tell her a story that has a grain of truth in it, heavily embellished.
Okay. Yeah.
Heavily embellished.
You think?
Yeah. So, yeah. Then there's a line that says, if we're fortunate to leave this island alive, I'm going to insist that we carry weapons, especially when we're not working on a case.
I had that line written down, and of course, they never do. No.
So, this is after that discussion that they were having about Dublin, and the storm starts and they hear the banging and they're going upstairs and they're going into the room where they find Dominic. And he says, I suppose this is one instance where ladies don't go first. Is that sexist? I mean, it seems a bit demeaning. Well, I mean, after all, you're just a woman. You probably don't want to go first, right?
Yeah. It's kind of insulting on both sides, because it's one of those things where, like, if you're saying this, I suppose it's this one instance where ladies don't go first, implying he doesn't want to be the one to go through the door, then it's kind of implying that he kind of wants her to be his human shield, which, ew. And then, well, the other way around,
somebody
as
else,
you said, it's implying
somebody's got to be somebody else's shield.
Well, true, but, like, you don't say it out loud. He said the quiet part loud, you know?
Well, back to that integrity thing. At least he's got integrity.
The other side of it implies that, yeah, like, why couldn't she go first? Like, I don't know. Yeah, it's kind of it's an awkward line.
They find Dominic hanging from the ceiling by a rope, which causes them to realize that, well, Somebody else saw the movie.
As we've been saying this whole time.
And, of course, then they find out that Randy was really behind it all, and she makes her
dun, dun, dun.
She makes her confession. She's got a boat moored on the next island over. It's just 2.6 miles from their island with the current.
She swims every day.
Yep. And, of course, we find out that the reason that she was wanting to kill Dr. Bells is because he had butchered her during cosmetic surgery because he was drunk. She's really got some issues.
Oh, yeah. She's got a whole magazine.
Most of the rest of the murders seem to be personal. Bells, you can understand, given what she described he did.
Oh, yeah, for
but
sure.
The rest of them, that just seems like...
But she didn't even kill Bellows, or at least...
No, well, not directly, no.
He killed himself. So, like, theoretically, if that was her biggest bone of contention, then he's gone. And I guess, she had a right to be mad at Ambrose because he basically screwed her out of what would have been an empire. But the others, I guess, like, they all seem, especially Madeline. Madeline's kind of the one that's the most...
You would think that Madeline and Randy would have some sort of common empathy toward each other.
But he's a common enemy. Yeah. Because Madeline got screwed over just as much as Randy did. So it's a kind of an odd thing. And using her supposed bimbo personality to get what she wants was, I mean, it's clever for sure.
Yeah. So she admits everything without really good explanation for some of it.
No.
And then they manage to get the drop on her by hitting the videotape, distracts her.
Yeah.
And grabbing the gun from her, and that's that.
Yeah.
And then we see them back in the office, and the honesty goes out the window.
Kind of flies out the window. Yeah, it's gone.
Honesty is the new watchword around here. Good. We'll start with your real name.
Okay. What's your name? Well, did I talk about the honey thing?
And, of course, Murphy gets a shot in because Steele starts, as William Shakespeare so aptly put it, a rose by any other name still has thorns.
Still has thorns, yep. And it's interesting as well to note that when they come in, Laura says they got to know each other quite well. Bernice, you can see on her face she thinks something happened, which is never obviously picked up on again. But you got to wonder if Bernice assumed that they tried the honey and walnut thing. That's going to be my euphemism now on. Did they try the honey and walnuts? It could have just been a recipe.
Yes. Well, because that's what he was describing it as, is women swapping recipes.
Like so much. Yeah.
Although it was specifically in the context of their sexual predilections.
Maybe they just got mixed up. You know, we did this thing this one time where you took one pound of walnuts and that's my recipe for pancakes. Okay.
I always get those two things confused, sex and pancakes.
I always get them confused.
Well, that's the end of the episode.
What a fun place to leave it.
Yes. The website is the home of all things steel watching, www.steelwatching.com. There you'll find the show notes, Amazon links to the movies that we've mentioned, and maybe a few other things we mentioned
there
in passing.
A lot in this episode.
We'll probably do the book and the movie of Cuckoo's Nest.
Yeah.
And then you're going to find links to some other resources such as...
Pancake recipes. Sorry.
Where you can buy your natural organic walnuts and honey.
Now you can try the honey thing at home.
And tell us how it works out for you.
Literally, we want to know how it works. No, the Steel Watchers Facebook group, which is a wonderful place to discuss all things steel, as well as fan fiction links and, you know, fan videos and all kinds of fun things that people just do because they love the show so much. So that is a great place to come for all your steel watching needs.
Yes. And pancakes. Yeah, and pancakes. So yeah, the Facebook, the Twitter, Instagram, Steel Watchers.
Twitter and yeah, sorry, my brain.
You're still back there swapped on the out there for, walnuts.
Still thinking about. I'm hungry. It's almost dinner time. I'm hungry.
So the next episode is going to be Stealing the Show.
I love this one.
Refresh my memory.
This is the one with Veronica Kirk.
Yes.
The movie queen. Yeah.
The B movie actress who loves to die. In every scene that she has.
Yep.
Every movie that she has.
So, yeah, that's one of my favorites of season one. I think it's a cute episode.
So that's for next time, and we'll see you then. Mm-hmm. So bye-bye, everybody.
We will. Bye-bye. I don't know why I'm waving.
I don't either. Hey, everybody. Eric and Sarah here. Just a quick announcement to let you know that, yes, we do appreciate everyone who listens, participates, and supports the podcast in whatever way you do. But we wanted to give an extra thank you to those who are so graciously giving to be monthly financial supporters.
We are making live streams of our recording sessions available to anyone who is a monthly financial supporter. So not only can you watch us live as we record our podcast episodes, you will be getting access to the raw, behind-the-scenes, unedited version of episodes before they get officially released.
And Sarah, does that include our mistakes and screw-ups and our humiliating...
Oh, yeah. Yes, every it does. Single one of them.
Every single one of them, yes. So again, this is just an extra thank you to those who are going above and beyond. But whether you choose to become a monthly financial supporter or not, we still love you. We want to say we thank you for your support, your encouragement, and your feedback.
If you want to become a monthly financial supporter, please visit our website at www.steelwatching.com to sign up.